Welcome to the Do Your Good podcast series. In this podcast series, you'll hear from me, Sybil, and other experts in the field to help you make your money matter and make a huge difference in the world. I come to you with over two decades of experience as a person who's helped donors give away over $45 million in donations, both large and small. This podcast series is meant to give you the tools you need to be effective in the world and fund nonprofits and issues that you care about with meaning and purpose, and to make a true, deep difference in the world. Hello, everyone. I'm pleased to play for you a rerun interview with Geneva Wicki. She has very valuable advice for us about how to give well to Indigenous communities. And it's I found it a very fascinating conversation. So I want to replay it for you today. As you all know, I'm busy at work focusing in on a new podcast series I'm doing this fall. So I'll let you know what it is soon. It's a surprise. But until then, I'm replaying some of my favorite episodes for you. Have a great listen. Geneva, I am so happy you're on my podcast today. Geneva, I was just totally impressed with you when I interviewed you for a project I'm doing for Hewlett, a consulting project for Hewlett Foundation on wildfire and how communities are responding to wildfire. And Geneva, your advice on what donors should do and how donors should think about funding, especially Indigenous communities, and your personal life story, it's just so wonderful. I think that my listeners will get a lot out of your advice and your wisdom and how to support both Indigenous communities and also just how to support communities in general, especially when you as a funder have maybe one particular issue you care about, but how to think more globally and more broadly, you know, in general about how to support communities. So Geneva, before we get started in talking about just your specific tips on how we can be better funders altogether, let's talk about your personal journey. Like, who are you? my listeners are interested.
Great. Thank you. Well, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here. So I'll introduce myself in Yurok language. So Ayukwi, greetings, everyone. Neknow Geneva Wicki. I am a citizen of the Yurok Nation of Northern California and a descendant of the Talua Dene people of the Smith River. And I come from the village of Rekwoy at the mouth of the Klamath River in the heart of the Redwood Forest in very Northern California. And I'm one of, you know, maybe two dozen Native Americans who work in philanthropy as their profession. In especially mainstream philanthropy. So I am a senior program manager at the California Endowment. And for the last several years, I got to live and fund and work in my tribal homelands of Del Norte County. And I currently live in Ashland, Oregon. I wasn't planning to work in philanthropy. I come from a long line of activists and tribal leaders. As I shared, my family lives in the place where we've lived since the beginning of time, and we recognize how lucky and privileged that is to be in our traditional homelands. And I come from a long line of leaders. So I'm named after my great-grandmother, Geneva Brooks Matz, who was a basket weaver and a language speaker and an educator. And up until, you know, the very end, she was an activist who, you know, put herself in a boat going toe-to-toe with federal agents who had machine guns and full riot gear to protect our rights to fish when she was, you know, well into her 70s. Or my uncle Raymond Matz, who sued the U.S. government in a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and reaffirmed us as Yurok people on the river, but also reaffirmed our inherent rights to fish for salmon on the Klamath River. That was a landmark case that lots of tribes across the country were able to use to reaffirm their traditional gathering and fishing hunting rights as well. And then my Auntie Sue, Susan Mastin, was the president of the National Congress of American Indians, only the second woman to hold that office and the first from California. And I got to work for her for a brief stint when I first graduated college with a degree in public policy and got to go and work for her when she was the president of National Congress of American Indians. And so I ended up in philanthropy in one of those ways that I think, you know, right place, right time. It started before Pinterest, I had a shoebox, like a little shoebox.
I love that.
And when I would see things or get excited about something, I would clip it out and put it in this shoebox. And as York people and in my family, we were always taught that if you have rights, you also have responsibilities. And so I come from this lineage of folks with a big responsibility to give back and to fight for our inherent rights and whatever, you know, sort of policy era was impacting Native people at that time. So I grew up with that sense of responsibility and all from a very young age wanted to like be a good Indian and do good to your podcast name.
Well, you're definitely doing that.
So I ended up getting a degree in public policy and saw in the York newsletter that a tribal member older than me was getting a fellowship that was funded by a slate of private foundations that had come together to fund public policy fellowships for people of color to get master's degree in public policy. And I didn't know anyone in my family with a master's degree. I didn't know how you got a master's degree. So I cut this, you know, little article out about this tribal member and then called the tribal office and got his phone number and cold called him and said, awesome. You're getting a master's degree in public policy. I wasn't eligible yet. It was too early in my academic career. What did you do? How did you do it? And so just sort of like from that very first instance of private foundation funding, you know, basically paying a fellowship for me to go to graduate school and creating a path for me to go to graduate school. There's just been this long line of moments in my life where private foundation funding changed the trajectory of what happened to me, including, you know, one of my first jobs out of college. I worked at the Cesar Chavez Public Charter High School in Washington, D.C., because like foundation representatives had come to an event that we were at and handed us a brochure. Or I was at just a new student orientation in graduate school in Seattle and did my little intro and mid-career student came up to me and handed me his business card and said, I work for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I can't tell you anything, but I need you to send me your resume tonight. And a week and a half later, I was in New York City at the launch of the National Early College High School Initiative.
That's so great.
You awesome. Know, so, yeah. So I would say there's so many ways in which private philanthropy has really opened doors and created opportunities to get deeper and deeper engaged. And so how I ended up at the California Endowment, I started a high school on my reservation.
It was of course you did.
Right. But you could, there's the story of like first getting an internship at a, you know, a startup high school in Washington, D.C., doing really innovative work, laid a bunch of groundwork, and then going to graduate school in Seattle and getting involved with this early college initiative with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I wrote my degree project on it and ended up working there after right out of grad school. And then when it was time to come home, I worked for my tribe as the deputy executive director of the York tribe. And then the community asked me to start a school. And I had all of these experiences that had right prepared me for that opportunity. So I was running this high school out of the back of the old Klamath Market on the reservation right next to the tribal office. And it was this, you know, dilapidated old building where half the time we didn't have hot water or heat. We had to plug the lights into light switches, you know, outlets to even make the lights work. And we were changing odds, right? We were changing student outcomes and we were practicing all of the best ideas we could dream as a community about how a revolutionary traditional-based education model might work and look. That was in 2005 when we opened. And so the California Endowment in 2009 chose 14 communities to invest in for a decade. And the promise was $1 billion investment across the state. And for, you know, a very remote, very poor county, Del Norte County, you know, the most isolated northwest corner of California, this was the biggest private investment that our community had known to date. And so sort of the good old boys of the county came and asked me if I would come and lead the community foundation as the sort of central kind of backbone organization of this 10-year initiative funded by the California Endowment. And so I did that for the first 5 years of the initiative. And then when my predecessor left, them was asked to come on to and be the funder and work at the California Endowment funding the Building Healthy Communities initiative.
And now for an ad, but don't go away, because Geneva is going to talk about how philanthropy can do even better and her advice on how we can improve next. Hello, everyone. I want to let you know that I am putting forward a pretty exciting new podcast season, which is going to focus on the journey I took with one of my clients to think through effective funding strategies to reduce firearm-related suicide in rural and remote communities, specifically looking at Oregon as an example. So tune in to my podcast series September 30th through October 21st. Every Monday, I'll have a new special episode specifically discussing this issue. Thanks a lot.
You know, for me, you know, having come from running a tribal government and then running my own nonprofit school, working with a whole host of foundations from the Walton Foundation to, you know, small private donors to the community foundation, the federal government, state funding, I learned a lot about what was helpful and not helpful from the perspective of a nonprofit leader or a tribal leader or school leader. And really try in my role as a funder now to emulate, you know, the best and really, you know, lean on my own Indigenous values of reciprocity and respect and really believing that power lies in relationship. And so how do we develop meaningful relationships with the communities and the people, the organizational leaders who we want to be in service of? From the time that I was working at the Community Foundation and, you know, was sort of at a more level playing field in terms of the power dynamics to when I did shift to statewide funder role, my personal relationship shifted for sure. There was a lot to navigate, including my poor husband had to find a whole new career path because he was basically conflicted out of any community or tribal work.
Oh, interesting. At that time.
God bless him. Oh, he is a saint. And for me, one of the ways in which I maintained healthy relationships and was able to feel like I was centered in my own values and could do this work in a way that felt congruent with who I was as a Native person and a member of that community, you know, and living and working there, was to be really upfront and honest about what was possible and what was not possible. So what I had control over and didn't have control over, and to be as explicit as possible about what the intentions of the funding were. And not to say theory of change, but really, like, at the end of the day, how the California Endowment believes that money will be a vehicle to create transformation and health equity as a health funder. And in that, you know, there's that really delicate balance between, you know, community driving change and philanthropy coming in with its own agenda. And that balance of creating enough space where people can actually dream and community can dream. Mm-hmm. And so a few things I had going in my favor. One was the California Endowment made a 10-year commitment to our community. And so with that, there was permission to try things. And there was no big push that everything had to be perfect out the gates, that we needed to have it all figured out. No one asked us to create a 10-year plan, but instead it was really like, let's build relationship. Let's do root cause analysis. Let's really create space to dream. So the commitment was for our community, the commitment was $1 million a year for 10 years. So it was originally a $10 million commitment. We spent, you know, more than double that in the community. And we did create a process in which the community had some dreaming and did create a plan and did set some priorities. And it was a logic model.
Love that. It's great that you're talking about that. And now for an ad, but don't go away because there's lots more to talk about. Hello, everyone. I'm so glad that you're enjoying my podcast. In my podcast, I hope to talk to you, the wonderful donors and philanthropists that I work with, to help you think through the most effective way to make your money matter. I also, in my podcast series and through all my trainings, want to help and support the nonprofits that are out there trying to raise money and hone their pitch. Because I'm somebody that works with donors, I get pitched all the time by amazing nonprofit leaders, so I know what it takes to raise money effectively. Please check out everything I have to offer at www.doyourgood.com. I have a whole host of course materials and lessons, videos, downloadable documents, a blog that I keep updated. All of it is 100% free for you to see and review and learn from. Please check it out. Again, www.doyourgood.com. Thanks a lot.
By making a 10-year commitment, I believe we created enough trust that community could then say, okay, I'm going to commit some time to actually tell you what's real. Most of our grants require, there are outcomes and indicators that people report on. We really co-develop those with the grantee, with our partner organizations. And a lot of them are focused on capacity building. So rather than
important point,
you're going to change these population outcomes or those sorts of pieces, it would say, like, we're going to improve our capacity to apply a racial equity lens to our work. What that might look like, how that plays out is going to be determined by, right, the set of factors of that group of people or, you know, whatever the circumstances are. So there, you know, we intentionally try to create more flexibility, more ability to be responsive. I'd say the other tool in the toolbox was I got to be an embedded funder. So for the 14 places that the California Endowment invested in for 10 years in this Building Healthy Communities initiative, there were 14 Genevas who were embedded in those communities. We call them like catalytic funders or embedded funders. And we knew ahead of time what our budgets would be, our annual budgets, we knew years in advance. So we were able to community and plan ahead. We also had some really amazing tools at our disposal, like the ability to make small grants rapidly. So for at the California Endowment, we have $25,000 and less that we consider a small grant. It requires no application, no reporting on the side of the partner organization. And we are able to get those funds out fairly quickly. And often what we find, right, is that it's not actually the funding isn't necessarily the tool that's going to make the change. It's when and how that funding is able to come. So we saw, you know, several $100,000 grants sort of come and go and not really make a very big impact. And then we could see like very strategic $10,000, $5,000, even one time it was like buying the lunch at an event.
Totally. Isn't that so interesting? It's not always about the amount of money, like at all.
Yeah. No, in fact, we actually, in the early years of the initiative, we saw a few nonprofit organizations close their doors after receiving a 2-year, $300,000 or $600,000 grant. And so the power of those small grants, but part of it was that we got to be in the room, in the conversations with the partners as they were dreaming and strategizing and creating plans together. And so we could be really responsive. There wasn't a, you know, once a year sort of visit. We were really accessible to community partners. And in that accessibility, we're able to, one, hold space. So to be able to say, like, actually, we can dream bigger or we can be more brave or more bold. And we got your back, right? We're here with you is one. And then two, in those moments, like, oh, we can't pull this off because we don't have lunch for the firefighters, was the one with the cultural burns. We could say, oh, we can just buy the lunch. Don't worry about it. Right. Don't let that be the obstacle. Right. And that, again, just gave partners the ability to, I think, take more bold action and know that they had a partner who would be there for them. If your listeners don't know, philanthropy giving to tribal communities is still dismal. So it's less than 0.5% of all foundation giving goes to tribal communities, tribal governments, tribal led organizations. And a new report recently came out by the Center for Effective Philanthropy that said even in COVID, where tribal communities were the hardest hit in a lot of instances from the COVID epidemic and also were the best able to respond to the COVID pandemic, that philanthropy funding did not improve or increase in during this pandemic to tribal communities. So there's just so much work to do to help raise the profile of why and how you can give to tribal communities. And also, I think for us to understand what are the barriers for donors to fund in tribal communities and Indigenous efforts. So, you know, for me, one of my favorite stories of my work over the last 10 years was when we first launched the Build and Healthy Communities Initiative. And I shared this story with you in our previous conversation where, you know, we're a private health foundation. Our headquarters are in Los Angeles. Our CEO is a Black pediatrician who lives in LA. And as they imagine the Build and Healthy Communities Initiative and what community might say would be the path to health, no one in their wildest dreams would have thought that my community in Yurok Country in the Redwood Forest would say forest fires would be the path to health. And yet, of course, it's the first thing that our community said when we created enough space to say we can actually tell the truth and talk about what would be like the really big thing that would change and improve our health outcomes in our community. And for folks who don't quite know that story, I feel like there's a lot more understanding about prescribed burns and cultural burns now than there was a decade ago, unfortunately, due to the wildfires in the West and other places. But for us as Native people, traditionally, we managed the lands in a way that created balance and allowed for prevention of uncontrolled wildfires. And one of our biggest tools was prescribed forest fires, including like landscape burns that created prairies for big game to come, that created opportunities for our sticks that we use for important materials like our baby baskets that we carry our babies in, or our virtual and cultural clothing and regalia, our basket caps, etc., that those reeds need to have enough room to grow long and straight. And when we don't do prescribed burning, all the kind of underbrush and berry bushes and those things create a lot of fuel for wildfires to get out of control. And so our community said the first thing we want to do is create a cultural burn, a prescribed burn plan. And now that that work's been going on for, you know, nearly a decade, the interagency coordination is spectacular. And there is a workforce pathway and an education pathway from elementary school all the way through to be, you know, professional master's degree level burn bosses. The Indigenous wisdom of how to prevent wildfires is, you know, a gift to everyone. And if we could apply those that ancient knowledge in the way in which we would have traditionally, we could really do fire prevention in a dramatic way that would benefit everyone. A few of the lessons there included things we've already talked about, like having relationships and being able to build trust, but also being able to create the space to really listen to what community really needs. And what the, you know, there are so many problems on the Yurok Reservation, especially, you know, a decade ago, we had a suicide epidemic. There is, you know, an opioid epidemic. There's a huge lack of infrastructure. So often there, you know, is no electricity or no telephones to a lot of the reservation, no broadband access. And so when we think about, you know, where do you start? Like that feels overwhelming. That feels daunting. To think about how would we actually start to tackle the multitude of social and health issues facing people. So often I feel like we would, what do we call it? Like poverty Olympics, where we sort of get into the trying to compete with each other for who has the worst social and health outcomes. And instead, I always love to start, and one of my good mentors at the Yurok tribe would always start with how rich our community is. And so how rich we are spiritually and culturally, how rich our natural resources are. The fact that we get to live on the Klamath River in the heart of the Redwood Forest, where the Creator created us there to have want for nothing. And so the natural state of being is one of plenty. The Tala will call it the place of plenty. Yes. If you drive through Delmar County now, you would see dilapidated homes and crumbling infrastructure and people actively doing meth, walking on the streets, and homelessness. And if you looked at the data, it is, you know, the education data and other, it's not great. But to know that the true natural state of those communities is one of a place of plenty feels like the place to start. Mm-hmm. And to say there's so much strength and wisdom and power and knowledge and inherent good here. How do we build from that? And how do we apply all of what's good in a way to make things better?
I'm just so inspired.
Yay.
Thanks for all your words of wisdom, Geneva. And I just thank you for all the work you're doing as well. Thank to make you. The world a better place.
Yay. Thank you.
So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as I enjoyed making it for you. So if you want to find out more about what I have to offer, please check out www.doyourgood.com and learn more ways to make your money matter. Until next time, do your good and be well.